Well, 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 if it isn't another episode of Ball Gag, the podcast, which I love so much. Guys, I'm actually really excited to sit down and do this week's episode. Not because I have any, like, stellar hot topics to discuss, but just because, I don't know, I feel like I've just missed doing my podcast, even though I've been doing it, even though it's done, been happening. I'm feeling fun. I'm feeling flirty. Not really. I feel sassy, maybe is a better word, and confident because today I cut my own hair. I gave myself a haircut, okay? Now, you've probably tuned out after I said that first statement, but here's why you should stick around. Insert reason here. No, okay. No, for real, it's such a small thing. Such a small thing to cut your own hair for the first time in your life, but I will tell you kind of my reasoning behind why it does feel good. They say in like 12-step programs and stuff, the only way to build self-esteem is by doing esteemable acts, right? Now, cutting your own hair isn't necessarily an esteemable act, but it is a new skill with that I didn't previously have experience with, and it was an act, and I feel some semblance of confidence came from that. That self-esteem, like, the reason why it means so much to me, I think, is because I don't have, like, growing up, everything in my life was done for me. I didn't really have a lot of practice doing shit for myself. And even though those aren't necessarily esteemable acts, in a small way they are as you're a child. You know, I didn't have any chores growing up, nothing like that. Nothing where I felt encouraged and confident in myself to even do simple acts, you know. So there is a certain pride in someone who was as deed deprived as I was growing up. There is a certain confidence and a worth and a pride when you do something so simple as doing your own hair or cutting your own hair and having it turn out pretty good. Because the way I approach a lot of things, the reason why I'm like scared to try so many new things is because, like, I'm not prepared to call myself a perfectionist. But I do, when it comes to new things, I get very tired of new things if I'm not great at them right away. Okay? I'm looking to make a joke in that, but there is none. Okay. What I mean is any new hobby. That's why, like, I didn't hate school. Because I was naturally good at school, humble brag. But when it comes to new things, like, I just get tired of things that I don't naturally exceed at immediately, which is why stand-up, I think, is such an exception to that rule, because it's like, everyone's horrible when they first start, but it really goes to show how much I love it based on the fact that I wasn't, like, naturally good at it from the second I stepped on the stage. But still have continued to pursue it and to conquer it, even though it is one of those things that is not, you can't perfect. It's an ever-changing thing. Like, you might get in some case, like, even if you come up with the perfect act, even if you come up with the perfect hour of material, and that sustains you for your whole career, every room is going to be different, so you never actually get to perfect that. I mean, you could, I guess you can make the argument that no art is perfectionable, you know? You can't do that because art is subjective anyway. So I'm not fully prepared to call myself a perfectionist, but I think there is a lot of pressure I put on myself to be good at things when I do them for the first time, to be naturally gifted and special with those things, which is why it ends up fucking you over a lot of the time, or at least speaking for myself, you know, as is the theme of this podcast. It is a solo podcast. Speaking for myself, it ends up hindering you a lot, and it ends up causing no movement. It makes you stagnant because you're so afraid of not being perfect at something that it completely makes you stall and not even try something. So that's something that, like, I'm going to assume a lot of people have had to deal with. You know, I'm not the only one. Hopefully if you're listening, maybe you can relate. I don't know. But I just think that that's interesting. It's, you know, my mom always called me lazy growing up, and there is a lot of truth to that. But I think another layer of it is just the pressure you put on yourself to be perfect. So when you have the suspicion that you will not be naturally gifted as soon as you start a new hobby or vocation or even a simple act such as cutting your hair. I forgot how I started that sentence. My point is, like, when you're afraid you're not going to be great at something immediately, that might make you not move at all, and that might come off as lazy, even though that's not necessarily what's working there. Guys, this is a comedy podcast, but I talk a lot of psychology. Comedians are obsessed with psychology. I was just watching one, and they were delving into trauma, and they were delving into memories, and that what I caught from that was just so fascinating about how malleable our memories are, how the truth of a past event becomes so distorted in our minds as we age. That's a scientific fact, a scientific psychological fact, that our memories are so subjective. And you always kind of suspect that, you know, just there are simple things like, oh, I thought I told you that. You never heard me say that? Oh, okay, I guess one of us, you know. But as that relates to childhood and stuff, to past events, to important events, yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's you know, for so long, I was so averse to the idea of finding, love and relationship again. And that's because, you know, with most of my previous lovers and past relationships, whatever, unless, you know, there was really little, very little emotional connection, you do just remember the bad shit, you know, especially if it was more bad than good, then you complete, if, and I'm not just talking romantic relationships, I'm talking about any type of situation, any experience. If it's more bad than good, I would bet that most people only remember the bad. And there's a saying, like, try to remember the good times we had. Or not a saying, but you've seen that line in a lot of, like, movies and TV shows and stuff. Try to remember all the good times we had. And that's what it is. Like, you really have to try to remember the positives in bad experiences, you know? Like, I remember one time when I was 12, I went to, like, this camp for Serbian kids. Not like an internment camp. This isn't, you know, we're not, I mean, Slavs are dirty and should be persecuted, but, you know, this is America and this is where you go to escape. Just kidding. It was like a summer camp, but it was, for whatever reason, it was just for Serbian kids. And when I got there, I found out that it was actually a far more religious situation than it had been years previous. My father went there when he was a kid. And so his experience was so overwhelmingly great that he, you know, kept on recommending this place to me. So when I was a kid, I went and I spent 2 weeks at this Serbian camp that turned out to be very religious. We had to pray like 5 times a day, like for the meals and then this, that, like. And so as soon as I got there, I remember calling my mom and like freaking out, being like, please come pick me up. Like, this isn't what it was packaged to be. Believe it or not, the way my father packaged an idea was not how it was not actually the truth of the matter. So, and I could rant for hours talking about how bad it is to like raise people's expectations and raise people's hopes when there's no guarantee of that being delivered. So I get to this camp and I'm immediately upset because, well, first of all, I never enjoyed camps. I was an only child and like I'm naturally kind of antisocial. I'm not great at, I never was good at summer camps and stuff. So I get there and I immediately call my mom. I'm like, please come pick me up. She talked me down, I guess. And obviously, you know, she had just dropped me off. She's not going to pick me up and take me home. But it ended up being a wholly awful experience. And I'm sure there were some fun parts. I'm sure there was some laughing things, but it was really, really excruciating for me for the general reason that, you know, all kind of camps were where I didn't know many people or didn't know anyone, but also the religious aspect. It was that trip that made me realize I was an atheist, because I never had to think about it before. And so it was really that like forced religious part that I hated. And also it was like 100 degrees every day. And this is, damn, I should turn this into a bit. But what ended up happening one day was, okay, it was like 100 degrees. It was in Northern California. 100 degrees, you know, we went, we had, I can't remember if it was before or after breakfast. It must have been after breakfast because there was this like forced kind of mini mass, like the Eastern Orthodox equivalent of like a mass. It was some church ceremony and it was outside under these white tents. By the way, this is all very strange because Serbs in general aren't that religious. Like, you know, they're not the most pious people. So it's the morning, as I said, 100 degrees, and we're kind of praying. We're standing under this tent, just blistering heat. And so finally it comes to the end, and you have to walk down the aisle and then kiss an icon of Jesus, okay? Catholic shit isn't the only one that's weird. There's a lot of weird shit you have to do, I guess, if you're Eastern Orthodox as well. It's not just the Catholics with their weird symbolism, okay? So there's an icon of goddamn Jesus. I have to walk down the aisle and everyone kisses the Jesus and then walks away and then it's like either time for breakfast or some activity, I can't remember. I get to Jesus, I kiss him, and then as I'm walking out, I vomit. I vomit right on the floor, right on the grass. From like the heat, exhaustion, I don't know. But it was just like looking back, I mean, the irony within it is hilarious. The timing, great. Great, great shit. Like you couldn't, you it's like something that they wrote in The Office or something, you know? But I remember that. And I think even at the time I thought it was funny, yeah, because I mean, I kissed Jesus's face and then I vomited. And I was already, you know, I was like always a little goth on the inside. So the Satanism, the idea of Satanism came to mind. So that's like the highlight of how horrible that camping trip was. Do I remember anything good from that summer camp? No! Actually, there is one. I remember there was like a little dance, kind of like a mini prom or like a mini homecoming that they just had at the summer camp. And like, I forgot what it's called when like it's like a bunch of people, a bunch of kids. It's so weird that this is still a practice. Like, it's so weird that in general, like all of these like dances and pageantry and stuff among like opposite sexes of children still goes on in like so many different ways. But it's like all the girls are like sitting in this auditorium, I think. And then the boys, they go up one by one and then they ask like the girls sitting in the semicircle. They ask one to go dance with them or something. And I that's like a good memory just because, you know, I must have been 12, right? That's when you're like starting to have like crushes and puberty and like, you know, all of those little like butterflies of like, ooh, like boys like me. I like these boys. This one is cute. This one I didn't. So I remember, and I remember, because I think I was like, I was so, I maintained that I was ugly for those years, but I guess that other people say I wasn't, but I also just felt so hideous, and I think I was like the second or third girl to be chosen out of like this ring. So anyway, that's like the closest I have to like a positive memory from that camping trip, or that, not camping trip, like summer camp thing. But it is overall, I mean, if someone were to say the word Serbian summer camp to me, I would cringe, not remember the good shit immediately. So that's why I'm glad I was listening to that podcast. It was Whitney Cummings' podcast, and she said that there is a scientist who was talking about that the fact is, like, our memories are so malleable. Well, that's not really malleable. I remember those details pretty clearly. Or maybe I don't. Maybe I have applied more or less emotion to those specific events. But, wow, I really didn't think I was going to talk about... I completely forgot. I almost... Not that I forgot about that summer camp experience, but I never thought I would talk about it. I think it would be cool to make a bit out of kissing Jesus and then, you know, hurling chunks, but I never thought, but I didn't think it would necessarily come up on the podcast, especially on episode 16 of the Ball Gag podcast. Do I know what the name of my podcast is? I stumble over the words, even though it's already episode 16. Viewership is down. What's the deal with that? I cut my hair. Maybe that'll drive viewership. Just kidding. No one cares. I care. I care a lot about this podcast. I didn't care that much the past couple weeks just because my mind was very preoccupied with a lot of other shit. Good shit. But still, you know, the podcast is a priority to me. And it just feels good to have something. It feels good to have a completely self-made, self-churned, but, like, not that this is hard work, not that this is, like, my opus in the grand scheme of things. This may not be my greatest work, but it's nice to have something consistent and stable that is self-produced, self-made, self-sustained, that you get to call your own. And that's why I care so much, you know, about the viewership and about the spreading, is because I just want this to do well, because I really, you know, the past couple of weeks I wasn't as focused, but I really do care about this and about what I'm doing. Dude, thank God. Thank God, not that I believe in God, but thank fucking, you know, the universe, thank consciousness, unconsciousness, thank Allah, thank whoever the fuck you think, for evolution of self. Do you know how freaking important it is that we are always bettering ourselves, that we are always trying to evolve and change? I think if you're the same person from the time you're 18 to the time you die, that's sad. I mean, well, I don't want to completely generalize that, because there is a comfort in knowing, like, there's a comfort. Listen, if a person is a great person and they're the exact same way from the time they're 18 to the time they die, then that's great overall. But by and large, I think if you don't stop, like, learning or growing or maturing or changing your habits or whatever from the time you're 18 to the time you die, that's a sad life. And you probably, you know, that's like kind of related to Peter Pan syndrome and stuff like that. I don't really know. But I think about a lot. I feel like it comes up on the podcast a lot, you know, where I'm talking about, like, oh, when I was a kid, I was so XYZ. But now, thankfully, I've, you know, not transformed, but, like, whatever, changed, adapted, forward in a positive way that is not who I used to be. And I'm just, I don't know, I guess it's good to, like, bring it up and be grateful for that kind of shit from time to time, you know, because if, it's so important to just get better and better as a person, and hopefully, that's one of the reasons why I find it, why I feel like I haven't been the best with maintaining friendships with people. You know, there are a couple girls that I went to high school with or middle school with that I maintain, you know, friendships with and relationships with. But by and large, like, even friends I made when I was 19, 20, I've really let go of a lot of them. I've really let those fizzle out. And I may come to regret that one day. I may not. I really think a lot of it is just part of the comic brain, which is just like having such a low tolerance for people's behaviors and for people's, you know, like the judgment aspect of it, you know. But besides that, like, whatever comic brain excuse I'm using, I think also a part of why I have not necessarily been the best at maintaining long-term friendships and relationships with people is because of that growth and because of that adaptation and evolution and stuff, you know, like, because people outgrow people all of the time. And that's not something that should necessarily be shunned. I mean, I feel bad for my friends because some of them I have ghosted. Some of them I just, you know, kind of was giving crumbs to until they... Yeah, I never really ghosted any friendships. I was more giving them crumbs until they finally took a hint. But I think it's just because, like... And not to say, like, I'm so much better than them because I changed and grew faster than they did. I mean, people grow and change at different rates. I have one girl that I've known my whole life that some years we are very close, and then sometimes I'm over... not over it completely, like, I want this person out of my life, but just... We're not in the same stratosphere, like, psychologically or life move. I don't know how to describe it, but, like, so I have a person like that I will know until the day I die, but that sometimes I am closer to and sometimes I am not. And sometimes we are on the same fucking, like, wavelength. And then there's sometimes I have to, and this is where it's shitty that I don't express it clearly. I'm sure it's confusing and hurtful to the person when I kind of stop trying to make plans and things because I feel like we're not in the same headspace, like that we kind of grow set apart. I don't know. I Life is filled with regrets, you know, and I'm just a human being. I never claim to be a great person. I try to be a good person, but I make mistakes. Can anyone relate to that? I'm sweating. See, I'm sweating already just thinking about my fucking guilt. I feel guilt all the time. All the time I feel guilt. Why? I don't know. Even when I was a child, I felt guilt. My mom would, I don't know, guilt or like a, well, low self-esteem for sure. Anyway, my point is, like, I was talking about friendships. Oh, friendships as it relates to self-evolution. Yeah, I feel like that's why I haven't maintained a lot of long-term friendships is because I just, you know, people, mainly because of the fact that I'm 25. Like, I think there's a lot of pressure for people to be friends forever, to for childhood friends to make it to, you know, to make it to be each other's bridesmaids at their wedding days and all of this shit. Like, there's a lot of pressure for that. But I think the reality is, and someone I once dated told me this, said that, like, your 20s are full of kind of interchanging friendships and stuff and short-lived friendships and fleeting friendships because you're trying to figure yourself out. You're learning yourself. You're learning what you will and won't tolerate in other people. And you're just, and also, I think this is my addition. I just think your 20s and stuff are really the time where not just where you learn about yourself, but where you figure out what your values are and how you want to live your life. For me, it's difficult just because I feel like I spent most of my, like, up to the time I was like 22 or 23, I spent so much of my life trying to mirror my values and my hopes and dreams and expectations on my mom's, like a little bit on my mom's and a little bit on, like, okay, one time I was in like a shitty relationship, but I was trying to like mirror my values and shit, like, for this person. I was trying to conform to like what he wanted me to be. So for a long time, I was not capable of seeing that. And finally, thankfully, in the past few years, I've realized, like, no, you, how you were raised shapes you, but it doesn't define you. How the values and the priorities with which you were raised do not have to be identical to how you continue to live your own life moving forward. And, you know, some people don't even have to think about that. Some people are granted the freedom to form their own opinions and to kind of mold their own values and define their own values from a very young age. Some people are given that freedom, but for me, it was not. And I don't mean that in like a blaming my mom way. I mean, she was just doing what she thought was right. And she did, I think, do a great job, you know, not like, and not in like a me tuning my own horn way, but like, I'm just saying, like, compared to like the kind of shit people that exist in this world, I know, like, I have my own code of ethics and morals that I will never break. Which, listen, like, my mom, yeah. Oh God, there was a saying, I'm just remembering, my mom was talking to this woman who's also a mother, and my mom reported this conversation to me, and I can't remember exactly how it went, but the end of this conversation was these, my mom and one of her friends saying, you know, it's like, you want to raise your kids to be good, honest, wholesome people. And then we're surprised when they turn out to be naive. So I bring that, I just got reminded of that because I was talking about how, like, compared to a lot of people, you know, my code of honor, my code, like, I know immediately what is good or what is bad. When someone says, like, when someone proposes an idea to me, I'm a immediate gut reaction of like, no, that's good or evil or whatever. Unfortunately, but I was reminded of that conversation because unfortunately, I feel like my code of honor, I don't know what the fuck to call it. That's probably not accurate. My morality, the morality policeman that lives inside me, unfortunately, I feel like that gets in the way of a lot of success, personal success. And I've had conversations with tons of people in entertainment about this, but especially now with comics, because, you know, it's those are the people I feel most free to talk to about this kind of stuff. You know, there's a lot of shady shit that goes on when it comes to business, when it comes to becoming successful at whatever field you're in. And I just know that there are certain things that I'm just not capable of doing certain things. And I hope that doesn't become a detriment to me. I hope this is just a little bit of an anxious, an unnecessarily anxious mosquito. That's a Big Mouth reference. An anxiety mosquito just like buzzing, being like, well, maybe. Hopefully it's not true. Hopefully I can reach my goals without having to have this moral compass fucking battle going on in my life as I continue to work, you know, in my field. But Jesus Christ, how did I get there from talking about evolution of self? Yeah, basically just that, like, my mom did well. Oh, I credit my moral compass or whatever. The thing that gets in my way, that makes me a good person but will probably get in my way. Yeah, I don't know why I'm saying that. It's never really gotten in my way before. I don't think I've missed out on anything because I was like, no, I can't do that. That would be bad of me. I don't think I've actually missed out on anything, so I don't know why I have this fear. But, yeah, my mom is, like, she is responsible for that. You know, she's actually a very fair judge. Very fair judge. She actually plays devil's advocate a lot. I remember how much that annoyed me as a child. Like, if I was talking about some little drama as a schoolgirl or whatever. And sometimes I would get annoyed when my mom would take the other person's side and present their side. But now I realize, like, what a great trait that is, and how glad I am that she would discuss things with me like that, you know, because I feel like the devil's advocate thing is something that, A, you should have as, like, a rational, functioning human in our society. It's, devil's advocate relates to empathy. And also, you know, as a comic, it's like comedy is just, stand-up comedy is just always playing devil's advocate, you know? I guess what I'm trying to say is part of being in your 20s is figuring out what you are and are not cool with. And that contributes a lot to, the morality thing contributes a lot to, like, the types of people you associate with. And how that affects your values and stuff. Because there are a lot of people in this world that I am going to have to be working with, knowing, maintaining friendships with, etc., who live in ways that I don't approve of, that I secretly don't approve of, that I might even think are disgusting. But unfortunately, I'm going to have to be okay with these things. I don't know what I'm saying. I completely lost my train of thought when it comes to that kind of stuff. But what I do want to talk about a lot more specifically is abuse, okay? I consider myself to be a highly abusive person. It's how I haze people. It's how I hazed my boyfriend. I just, you know, I subjected him. I hit him over the head with a frying pan, and you know, he took it. He cried a little bit, but he took it. And that's just, you know, if you can handle my abuse both physically and verbally, because I called him a word that I'm not going to say on the podcast, then I know you're down. Then I know you're ride or die, and you can hang with me. If you can, like, if you could tolerate, like, a little bit of a beating in the beginning, not just with my boyfriend, with my friends, if I can fucking beat you and make little incisions with a kitchen knife on your skin, dude, we're gonna be best friends forever. So that's why, like, abuse, you know, abuse this, abuse that, everyone says it's bad. I think it's a great way to know who's ride or die. And that's how I'll continue to live my life. You don't have a French bob haircut and not, you know, slap people around from time to time. That satirical little monologue is over. I saw the word abuse in my notes just because, like, it was brought up recently, a few days ago. I was talking to my boyfriend. I mentioned the fact that the silent treatment is something that I have been, like, the victim is a strong word, but, like, I've experienced being on the sad end of the silent treatment for a long time, and I just want to discuss, like, because nobody, you don't think, I don't know how many people are in close relationships with people who do the silent treatment shit, but it is really one of the most harmful ways of dealing with confrontation or disagreement. It is one of the most unhealthy defensive or offensive mechanisms, you know? Because, listen, I hate when people, like, my mom is the greatest, but when we do have disagreements, she does do the silent treatment, which is really one of the most harmful ways to treat people. And she doesn't completely ice me out. I mean, she'll still take my phone calls, but they're always very terse, and she wouldn't, you know, be upset if I didn't call her. But she's not an extreme example of it, but it still is so painful when you're on the receiving end of that. And I'm sure a lot of, thankfully, I've never experienced that in any, like, romantic relationships I was in, and also never no, like, friendships I was in, I don't think, where the silent treatment is an option. Like, ghosting, I guess, is a light version of that, but with ghosting, it's usually not people that you're very close to emotionally anyway. It's usually just some, like, fuck head, fuck boy, fuck girl that, you know, doesn't know how to properly express that they don't really give a shit about you. I mean, I've done that countless times. Not recently, but you know what I'm saying. So the reason why the silent treatment to me is so harmful, you know, is because it completely rejects I hate the word victim, but I'm just going to call that person the victim for the sake of verbal ease. It completely rejects the victim as even an idea. When you get into an argument or a disagreement with someone and person A decides to no longer speak to that person who they know they have to speak with. It's not like it's a stranger that you can just stop talking to and, like, nobody gives a shit. If it's, like, a parent or a spouse or whatever, if person A decides to give the silent treatment to person B, it's a complete emotional, physical, mental rejection of person B, of the victim. And it's so harmful because it's so extreme. Because, like I said, it's like you're not even an idea that exists anymore in my mentality. It just because, like, it causes such a state of turmoil in the victim of, like, wait, so you're not even gonna yell at me? You're not even gonna expend a thought? Because from the victim's perspective, it's like, wait, you're not even gonna waste or spend a single thought or emotion on me after this disagreement, even though we love each other? I don't exist to you anymore because we got in a disagreement over something and there's nothing I can say? So it's very confusing, and it also makes the person be the victim. It also makes you feel like you have to, you have to apologize, even though there was a simple disagreement. I mean, sometimes I'm using a simple disagreement as, like, the lightest version of that scenario. But I think it feels like a very personal icing out. It's being iced out. So even though it's a kind of passive-aggressive way to treat an argument or a disagreement, it still feels like a personal attack because giving someone the cold shoulder or the silent treatment, it's like you don't exist anymore. Like, you're not even worth a moment of communication because we had this disagreement. And that's why it hurts so much on a personal level, is just because, like, oh, this person that I have, like, an emotional connection to, what I mean, it happens a lot at, you know, in work. I'm not saying it just happens between people who love each other. I'm saying it, you know, and it happens in work situations and this and that. And it's harmful all across the board. And the reason why I said abuse at the beginning was because, like, now it kind of is being considered a form of abuse. And it's one of those sneaky ones for sure, because when you think about someone like, about like verbal, physical, emotional abuse, the silent treatment, as I said, is a very passive alternative, but it is, so you don't think of it as harmful, but it is. Also, so, okay, I just went into why it's so personally hurtful on like a more individual level, but think about globally, universally, like on a fundamental human way, in the human element, what greater punishment is there than being expelled from your society? What this is how people have been punished forever, from states, from countries, from kingdoms, whatever. Banishment is the worst. Banishment, you know, and banishment and silent treatment obviously are very different things, but they both, but they're actually not that different things, because they are both related to ignoring or being ignored, okay? Because listen, humans are necessarily communicative social creatures that require social connections and communication in order to survive. You can't argue that humans need socialization and need to feel like they're part of a tribe or something, even in like a basic, like even if it's just a few family people. Think about prison. The worst, kind of the worst, like, punishment they give, and this is what they'll say, they're like, there's nothing as bad as being put in the hole, as being put in solitary confinement. I just said being put in the hole as if that's probably such an outdated term for solitary confinement. It's probably from like 80s movies I've seen. In the hole. Or maybe I'm just confusing that with stand-up terminology. Anyway, solitary confinement, I think what a lot of prisoners say, people who have been released, is really the worst punishment they give to you in prison, because you need to be among people. You need to be among society, among peers, among friends, whatever. Humans need to talk to people, to be human, to feel okay, to survive, really. Banishment, if you were, you know, if you think about from the earliest human tribes or whatever, if you're outcast, you're toast. You're dead. You're done. Like, what? You're going to be go off by yourself in the woods? No, you're going to die. People need people. It's one of the most fundamental adages or whatever. So that's why that's like the kind of more basic levels behind or below what makes the silent treatment so harmful. And I bring it up, and I don't mean to say that, like, people who give you the silent treatment are like, abusers or are always, like, the worst people doing it consciously. Really, the silent treatment, I would argue most people who give you the silent treatment don't really know what they're doing. Like, they're not consciously trying to punish you. They are really just so conflict avoidant that they don't know, like, these people, they don't know how to talk about their feelings, how to express things properly. They don't even, and they're too scared to, like, yell or have more confrontation, so they do the silent treatment until they get over the problem themselves. So I'm not saying, like, I am saying how harmful the silent treatment and ignoring people is, but I'm not saying that the people who perpetrate that form of abuse, and I think way too many things are now being considered abuse. I'm not saying that they are evil people, that they are completely, you know, fucking, you know, enemies or foes or whatever. Because a lot of it is, because it is kind of passive, and a lot of it is just, you know, I don't know how to deal with my own emotions, and I can't handle getting emotional with you, so I'm just gonna, I can't talk to you. I'm not gonna talk to you for days or months or weeks or years or whatever it is. Again, very unhealthy. I would rather have someone yell at me for like an hour and just get it out and then be over it, you know? But I just think, but really, I just think that the most interesting part about that is, and forgive me if I'm beating a dead horse already, but just the how it relates to Homo sapiens' need for socialization and for human connection and emotional connection and bonding and stuff. And it that's why that form of confrontation, I don't know what the right word for it is, but that's why that form of resolution or lack of resolution is so fascinating to me, because it seems so passive, yet it is fundamentally anti-human. And I just think that that's really cool. And I'm glad that I kind of figured it out more, because as someone who has dealt with a parent who does employ the silent treatment, you know, it's very frustrating growing up when you're a kid and you don't understand that stuff. And now I'm just glad that as an adult, and hopefully if someone who's listening to this also understands, like, you know, that's what it is, you know, that sometimes the person giving the silent treatment is really just so fucked up about their own emotions. They don't mean to cause that damage. I mean, some people, of course, do it full well, knowing exactly what they're doing, knowing exactly, like, how much harm they are inflicting upon you. You know, but there's some empathy to be had for the people giving the silent treatment in a lot of cases. But also, you know, I feel like so much of therapy and psychology, so much of being human is just like, and trying to get over past traumas and past, you know, wrong ways in which you were raised. I feel like so much of moving past that is just, I just feel like so much of moving past that is just realizing why, is just understanding the reasons why X, Y, and Z happen in the way that they did. And understanding why already just, like, helps pave the road for healing. I mean, there were a lot of things that I got over. Like, little things, little disagreements with people, I get over them quicker when I understand why I was triggered, they were triggered, like, why this small little thing is, like, so disappointing and so catastrophic and stuff, why it feels so bad. It really helps when you just understand, like, the history. So that's all for this week. Oh, my God. Guys, I'd love to have a podcast. It feels good. You know, there's a lot of shit that goes on in this little noggin, in this little, you know. Let me see how much more I can breathe into the mic and just cause everyone woe and annoyance. This podcast is called Ball Gag. I'm your host, Lulu. I don't need a fake enthusiasm. You guys know who I am. Okay. Thank you for watching. Appreciate it.